All right. So, the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas is conducting a research project that seeks to preserve the history of various churches and other religious organizations in Kansas. We would like to record your memories of your experiences in religious organizations. We expect that each interview will take about 1 hour. We assure that you are not obligated to participate and may discontinue your involvement at any time. Since we are trying to create a public record of Kansas religious history, we are primarily interviewing persons who agree to let their interviews be available to the general public through a website to be identified by name as the person who is interviewed. Should you have any questions about the project, please contact Professor Tim Miller at 785-864-7263 or tkansas@ku.edu. If you have any questions about your rights as a research participant, you may call the Human Subject Protection Office at 785-864-7429 or email mdenning@ku.edu. Today's date is June 27th, 2018. All right, so first question is, what is your name?
Adam Lockridge.
Excellent. Would you mind spelling that for me?
Lockridge, Adam, A-D-A-M.
Thank you. Adam, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Olathe, Kansas.
Great. And where do you live now? Not like your specific address, but...
I live in Miami County, Kansas,
okay.
Which is about 30 minutes south of where I grew up, mm-hmm. Outside of Lewisburg in Paola.
Okay, yeah. So that's quite a drive to get here on Sundays. What's your commute like?
It's exactly 30 minutes from our house, yeah, okay. 69 Highway, yep.
All right, great. And would you mind telling me where Holy Trinity is located?
So Holy Trinity is in mm-hmm. Overland Park, Kansas, mm-hmm. Flum and 119th Street.
Wonderful. Can I ask what practice or religion you followed before converting?
Sure. So all Christian, mm-hmm. but many different varieties of Protestant Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I was raised in evangelical.
Okay.
And I attended Olathe Bible Church, mm-hmm. which is not far from here.
Mm-hmm.
And I attended Olathe Bible Church. I was very involved at Olathe Bible Church in high school, in my youth group, helped leading music, attended various Bible studies and in teen groups. And when I went to college, mm-hmm. I started to explore a little bit more. I was at a Presbyterian church for a while, a Lutheran church for a time. We tried Episcopal churches, kind of a variety. My wife and I, while we were at KU, mm-hmm. Took classes at the St. Lawrence Center,
mm-hmm.
Learning about Roman Catholicism, and we considered that for a while. We tried a Pentecostal church mm-hmm. for a while. We were in the PCA when we lived in Memphis for a few years.
Uh-huh.
So we've tried quite a number of Protestant denominations, mm-hmm. and for me as well as my wife, we found just that there was a little something missing, I think, in each one of them. And so we just sort of kept searching.
Excellent. Can I ask sort of what that piece was what was the driving factor sort of behind settling or not settling, choosing mm-hmm. Orthodox Church America?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is probably more personal, just mm-hmm. to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a questioner, so
okay.
I always had a lot of questions, and I was raised in churches where if you have questions, you go to the Bible,
mm-hmm.
Or you go to your pastor, who's going to pull out his Bible and explain it to you. And I tried reading my Bible quite a lot, and found myself with ever more questions, multiplying
yeah.
questions,
mm-hmm.
and that was difficult because I just wanted to know, you know, what's true, and in hopes that it would kind of give me some hints at how to live my life. And I was having a difficult time tracking that down. So
mm-hmm.
so for me, a big part of the search was kind of that, just questioning, you know, I ended up a philosophy major and really like Socrates, and that's been kind of my my approach throughout all of that, is just trying to ask questions and find out what's true. From a church standpoint, I think there are a few things that I found, I guess, as I said, were sort of missing for me. One thing was I was often encouraged by, you know, pastors and teachers to pray. You know, I was pretty clueless how to pray. I would hear people say pray, and I would think, I don't know what to say to God. You know, I mean, I can, you know, try to come up with the words, but it was something that was it was always a challenge for me. I just felt like I'm not having this experience that I see other people around me sort of having, you know, or seeming to have, you know. And being a little bit skeptical, I probably would have thought, seeming to have, you know, is this real? Yeah. And so there were those questions. So,
yeah.
So the prayer part of it, I felt, was hard for me to understand and appreciate. I think the second bit of it would have been a connection to history. So, you know, where did all of this come from? And, you know, I see all these different groups of Christians who claim to believe the same thing, but they don't agree on anything. And that was concerning to me. You know, I think trying to understand, or trying to look for more of a historical rootedness in Christianity was one thing I felt like, okay, this is missing. You know, I told you I was involved in music. I mean, I'm playing the electric guitar and, you know, singing in church, and then, you know, seeing these, you know, kind of more ancient, older churches, you know, some of them have organs, some of them don't have instruments at all, some of them have beautiful choirs, and just wondering, you know, it just kind of feeling like there's got to be more to this, both kind of in terms of practice and in terms of the history. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
That's great. So I guess flipping back around to what we were, an earlier question, can you tell me a little bit about the process of converting? Like, how long did it take?
Yeah.
Who was it? Was it Father Tim that was walking you through it, or just, you know,
so,
the process?
Yeah, sure. So our family converted to Orthodoxy almost, I can't remember, I could find out for you, it was 5 or 6 years ago. I think we're coming up on 6. At a parish in Memphis, Tennessee, called St. John's, which is part of the Antiochian Archdiocese.
Mm-hmm. And
the process is, you know, similar or the same in all Orthodox churches. You become a catechumen. Mm-hmm. And a catechumen is someone who's just involved in catechesis, or, you know, the training, the preparation for baptism and chrismation, or in our case, just chrismation. And so I'll maybe define those terms. But so in the Orthodox baptismal service, there's the immersion in water, and then there's the anointing with oil, mm-hmm. the anointing of the Holy Spirit. And so as a Protestant, I was baptized, mm-hmm. but I was not chrismated. And so when you're received into the church from a Christian background and you have been baptized, a lot of times they'll receive you into the church just by chrismation. So we were anointed, but we were not rebaptized when we came into the church.
Okay.
And then leading up to that was about a year's worth of classes that we took in the evenings, and we just basically went through the creed, and we went through just kind of almost talking through the creed word by word, line by line. I believe in one God, the Father Almighty. You know mm-hmm. the creed. Just kind of looking at each of those terms, thinking, okay, what does this mean? But I would say that probably even the more important part of catechesis, of sort of becoming a part of the church, is attending the services. Mm-hmm. You know, because when you attend the services, you you know, it's the music, it's the sacraments, it's the all the activity, you know, that you're participating in that kind of seeps into you and changes you, you know. And so it's kind of mysterious the way that it happens, but it's like, you know, you become Orthodox by participation, not just by kind of mental knowledge that you might get in a classroom. So that was the preparation, and then and so we were received into the church in Memphis, and then we moved back here as a family, and our whole family went through that process. So our children were chrismated as well. They had been baptized in the Presbyterian Church and then were chrismated, and so when we moved back here, it's interesting, I my old church is just down the street from here. I went to high school right around the corner, mm-hmm. and I saw this building here, and I never would have really even known what it was, and all of a sudden now this is our home,
You and your kids and your wife went through conversion with you. Mm-hmm. How many kids do you have?
Three.
Three? Okay.
We had two at the time.
Okay, so gotcha.
Our youngest daughter is the only one who was actually, she was baptized in the Orthodox Church.
Oh, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So how do you think living in the Midwest, living in Kansas, you know, Tennessee, has influenced your conversion journey? For example, there are considerably less sort of like Orthodox churches in America than, say, Lutheran churches in Kansas. Was that like ever an obstacle, do you think? I know you said you jumped around from, you explored your faith a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Through different churches. So was...
Yeah, I mean, I think in a positive way. I mean, I guess I look back on sort of my eclectic religious background, and I'm very mm-hmm. thankful for it. I mean, because mm-hmm. I had, because, you know, Midwestern people, by and large, to me, are pretty pious, you know, God-fearing people, uh-huh. I guess they call it the Bible Belt. I'm not exactly sure where that stops and starts, but I mean, you know, I grew up just around people who cared about the faith. They want, and they taught it to me in so far as they mm-hmm. knew how and were able. And so, so I guess just being raised in that culture, it gave me a hunger for that, you know, and that was part of what sort of fueled the surge. But yeah, of course, the challenge is like, well, and this is probably actually another piece of it too, living in the Midwest. It's like there's a church on every corner, and they're all different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I grew up right basically next door to Mid-America Nazarene, but I went to an evangelical church. And my family sent me to a school that was not at all connected with the church, that had kind of their own take on the faith. And so I grew up in this environment where it's like, okay, all these different versions of the same thing. And so I think that was what really kind of gave me the questions I needed to kind of fuel that surge. But you're right. I mean, there's just a handful of Orthodox churches in the Kansas City area. But
mm-hmm.
the thing about, I guess, when you become, you know, when I converted to Orthodoxy, so one of the things that is taken very seriously in the Orthodox Church is the Holy Cup, communion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you in communion with the church or are you not? You know,
mm-hmm.
and so, so I am not. I'm not able as an Orthodox Christian to go take communion at a Lutheran church.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And so because that's sort of the Holy Cup is at the center of our life as Orthodox Christians, you don't move to another city and go, am I going to go to that church? I'm going to go to that church. Like, well, there's just sort of a small, you know,
yeah.
I mean, there's not a, you know, you might be surprised to know that there's not an Orthodox church in Payola, Kansas,
mm-hmm.
where I currently live. So, you know, driving, if I'm going to live there, driving here,
mm-hmm.
it's either driving here or just not going to church or going to another church but not communing, which
mm-hmm.
when you believe what we believe about that act, then that's not really an option.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not acceptable.
So, yeah, and, you know, just to compare my experience with other people in my family, the Eucharist, when it's the center, you know, it's the family of faith, the meal that we all sort of come around, that's a reason to get together, You know, I don't need to get together with anyone for a sermon. You know, I have a phone with plenty of podcasts lined up. You know, I don't need to go to church to hear a sermon. I don't need to go to church to have friends. You know, so if it's just about socializing, or if it's just about, you know, so I have family members who have completely stopped going to church. I have family members who have just continued the frustrating process of going from church to church to church, trying to find the quote-unquote right fit. Mm-hmm. My question is always like, well, why are you going in the first place? Mm-hmm. And I have a different answer for that. You know, I'm going to you know, receive the body and the blood of Jesus Christ, you know, mystically, of course. You know, it's not, you know, there's not actually blood in the cup.
Yeah,
you know? but mystically speaking, I believe that to be true. Mm-hmm. And because I believe that, that's a reason to get out of bed in the morning and go to church. So,
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for going into such detail on that. That's fantastic. Next question you've already answered is what sort of attracted you to Eastern Orthodoxy. So I guess my next question is, what sort of fellowship activities do you do at Holy Trinity here outside of just your regular worship services?
Fellowship activities, yeah. You know, when the Orthodox Church, there's a lot of services. I mean, you know, so I'm just taking like the easiest example, Holy Week. Mm-hmm. You know, when you participate in an Orthodox Holy Week, meaning the week leading up to Easter, you're in church. You know, if you're going to all the services, you could be in church, you know, twice a day or at least every day. You know, so I mean, in churches we were in the past, you know, we would do a lot more like outside Bible studies and potlucks and things like that, and you know, here we have a coffee hour every day or every Sunday after communion, so I get a good chance to socialize and spend time with people in the parish. One reason for that is that the Orthodox practice is to fast prior to communion, so you can imagine, you know, 100-150 people coming out of, you know, a long service not having eaten since the night before. It's like, okay, where's the food, you know? And so we have a coffee hour and we come down and we eat and we talk and drink coffee, and so that's a really good time to kind of bond with people. About once a year I go on a retreat with a group of men from the church. It's the Men's Lenten Retreat. We go to central Kansas to a Catholic monastery that has a retreat center. I think it's a Capuchin, maybe. No, it's a monastery. Anyway, we go out there and we have a weekend retreat, and so that's one of the ways I've really connected with specifically with the men of Holy Trinity. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, kids are always a reason to get together. You know, when you have children, it's like, okay, let's get together. We homeschool our kids, so they get together for homeschooling co-ops. You know, here at the parish, or,
and I mean,
you know,
your teachers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And I teach online, and so it's an Orthodox online school. Mm-hmm. So I you know, daily I'm meeting, you know, in these like web chat sessions with my students who, you know, share the faith and who we're teaching them in the faith. And so and then there's mowing. You know, I come and mow the churchyard with some guys, and you know, that's actually kind of a nice time to connect too. So you know, we have some adult education, and I was involved in that a couple of years ago. I'm not currently, but part of that's just because I'm really busy, but I'd like to be more involved in that too. So
Very cool.
So we got a lot going on.
This might be like some Ollie specific questions about these fellowship activities.
Yeah, no,
but like,
go ahead.
During coffee hour, do you guys like serve food? How long does that last? What does that look like?
It depends a little bit. So, you know, like Pascha, for example, or Orthodox Easter, like, the famous meal is the after Pascha, because of course you've been fasting through Lent from meat, dairy. You're pretty much a vegan. I counted up the fasting days, it's about half and half, so we're kind of like half-time vegans, you know. But so you can imagine if you do eat meat and you haven't eaten meat for, you know, all of Lent, you're pretty hungry. And so, you know, people bring, you know, you know, beer and wine and, you know, and they bring meats and cheeses and we just, you know, we sit in here and this whole room is packed and we're all, you know, feasting together at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Right? Because your service is like at night. But that's like a once a year kind of thing, you know? So that's the really big, you know, the big meal, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then, you know, but then we have coffee hour, as I mentioned, afterwards, and that's kind of depends. So there are volunteers who provide that food, and sometimes it's potluck. And sometimes no one volunteers, and you, you know, hope you remember to pack the granola bars, you know? So it's kind of like, but I guess I would say on a typical week, you just eat some bagels, you know, like we did this last week, or maybe someone would bring pasta and a salad, and so we sit down and we have food together, and I usually kind of wander from table to table and talk to a few people, and then we drink coffee, and I like coffee, and the coffee here is not very good.
Church coffee never is, you know.
But you know what? It doesn't matter, because I just, you know, I like being around.
It's the fellowship.
Yeah, it's the fellowship, yeah.
That's, yeah, exactly.
That's it. Yeah.
You said you and a couple of the other men from the church do the mowing around here. Is that like a volunteer basis? So like one person does it one week. What?
Yeah, we have teams. Uh-huh. So one guy kind of administrates it, and he divides the people up into teams, and then we meet, you know, and then I coordinate with my teammates, and so it's just me and two other guys, and on my team, and one guy actually has his own lawn service, and he usually does his part like when we're not there, and then we meet on Friday mornings, and then you know, have gone out for lunch afterwards, you know, just to but yeah, so we have, you know, mowers in the shed and just doing that, so yeah.
And then you said there was adult education classes here.
Mm-hmm.
What do those look like? Are they
there's been more actually recently, so because I think there's been a demand for it, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are just saying, okay, you know, teach us. But a couple of years ago, and then I think it's probably one of those cyclical things where, you know, they'll do it for a while, and then they'll stop, and they'll do it for a while. But a couple of years ago, we started a Bible study where we were actually meeting in people's homes, mm-hmm. and we were reading one of the Gospels, I think it was Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And we just read we read through with, you know, using a commentary, and just we would meet a few times a month.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about it, and you know, usually have food there, you know, just getting groups of people together. And that was really great for us, because I think a lot of times what you end up doing when you study something together is bonding, is fellowshipping, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
It's about learning, but again, that's something, you know, if you're really motivated, you can do on your own, but mm-hmm. it's good to be able to sort of talk through things, and as you kind of bond as a community. So we did that for about a school year, and then we mm-hmm. stopped that. And then more recently, there's a priest who serves here, though he's not the full-time priest, but he serves here, and he's starting a Bible study, and he's going to try to go through the New Testament. It's going to be after liturgies on Sundays.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, those are for the really committed people, you know.
Yeah.
Because you go to coffee hour, and then you're doing the Bible. I'm sure some people will do it, but mm-hmm. we probably won't, because, you know, by that time our kids need their naps, and it's kind of so we probably won't be doing that. But
Whole New Testament's a lot to tackle.
Yeah, that's right. But then there's a Monday night catechism class for inquirers and people who are just sort of starting to learn about orthodoxy and faith, and so that's like kind of more the basics. And then there's also a program called, I think they're calling it Meet My Friends. And you know, one of the things that I love about the Orthodox Church is that it's not just about, like, I don't know, sort of like reading the text of the Bible and interpreting it, but we have all these great examples of holy lives mm-hmm. and the saints, you know. And so we look back in history, we see the saints, and there are probably saints living today, you know, but people for us to sort of look up to and emulate. And so that Meet My Friends is sort of a time where someone will come and give a presentation just on a specific, you know, person, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, someone from 1,000 years ago, or someone from, you know, who died just a few years ago, you know. But So it's kind of a celebration of the lives of the saints. So
that's very cool. That's really cool. Sunday school. Do your kids go to Sunday school, and what does that sort of look like here? Or children's church? What
yeah.
Do you, what's the?
Yeah. So we have. We have a Sunday school program. I guess we call it church school.
Okay. Yeah.
But we have that on Sunday mornings, and you know, when I was a kid, we would have it sometimes even during a service. You know, mom and dad go into the service, mm-hmm. and we would like go to our classes, or we
yeah.
would go in there for a little bit, and then we would leave, and then they would have their sermon, and we would have our activities or something.
Yeah.
But you know, the Orthodox practice is to commune children, you
mm-hmm.
know. So I mean, I have a 2-year-old daughter, you
mm-hmm.
know, she takes communion with the,
yeah.
with us as a family. So
yeah.
it's a family event. It's not always easy to have a 2-year-old in a long, you know, liturgy. So but then, you know, of course you finish that and then you eat and then there's some teaching time after that.
Okay.
That's And so we have kind of modest expectations for that, because about 45 minutes and, you know, the kids are already pretty tired. But
yeah.
We have a good group of really dedicated teachers and, you know, teaching on various topics, you know, just the life of Christ, the New Testament,
mm-hmm.
church history, spiritual life, all these things that are just kind of, you know, essentials.
Mm-hmm.
And we have program, you know, we have classes for K through, or pre-K really, through 12th grade. So,
okay,
and then, so what I was describing earlier, I guess, is more the adult education program,
yeah.
but there's also
the kids program.
And we're working on that too. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm involved in, trying to help, you know, kind of organize the curriculum a little bit to make sure that we're really kind of covering our bases in
mm-hmm.
the way that we're teaching our children. So.
Excellent. So what does a typical worship service look like on a Sunday for you?
On a Sunday, yeah. So, the liturgy is virtually the same
mm-hmm.
in its structure,
mm-hmm.
on any given Sunday, with the exception of there's the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, and then there's the liturgy of St. Basil, and those are
mm-hmm.
they'll do the liturgy of St. Basil occasionally, and there's a little bit different, like, prayers, but for the most part it's the same structure, and it starts it's interesting, you know, when I first came into an Orthodox church, it was just like, what in the world is going on here? You got these like guys wearing robes swinging these metal censers. I never seen anything like this before in my life. Smoke coming up and pictures on the wall, and you know, and they're like bringing, you know, they're like making all these processions and stuff. And the more I've been in it, the more I realize, so it's the same thing I was doing when I was in an evangelical church. You know, you get there, you sing a few songs, you hear a sermon, you know, and then you take communion, and then you go home. You know, I mean, it's actually a pretty basic structure. The interesting thing about an Orthodox church is it's almost all chanted or sung.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so music is a huge part of it, and so it sort of it defied my expectations in a way, because I would expect someone to get up and give sort of a speech, but a lot of it is just, it's scripted, you know. There's a book where you can follow along in the text, and you just go from beginning to end. The thing that does change is the hymns.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you have, the hymns and the text that you're using from the gospel and the epistles,
mm-hmm.
and the saints that are being commemorated on that day, and every Sunday has a specific focus.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have different music, you know, depending on the season, you know, the music changes, you know, during Lent you're going to have
yeah.
more kind of sober, kind of contemplative, even sad kind of tones, and then, you know, during Easter you're going to have your, you know, kind of
yeah.
bright, exciting, you know,
yeah.
music. And so but the structure of the Sunday morning is pretty you know, you could set your watch to it,
uh-huh.
and it's like, you know what's you know what's gonna happen. So
excellent. How is the church governed? Is that, do you have a set of committees and boards and a council, or is it top down, bottom up?
Yeah, so just at the local level, we have what's called the parish council.
Okay.
So those are, you know, members of the church in good standing who are, you know, making just day in and day out decisions about, you know, are we going to have this festival next year or not, and can we afford it, and, you know, who's going to mow the lawn, and are we going to hire someone, are we going to get volunteers? You know, so there's just those day in, day out decisions that, you know, a pastor or a priest, he can't make all those decisions by himself, you know, and nor should he. And so so there's a parish council that that makes those decisions. But that's kind of on a functional, like, management level of the church. But then you also have, like, you know, spiritual authority, you know. So I you know, for example, I'll go to confession to my priest, and he might tell me, you know, you need to repent of that sin, or you need to go ask this person for forgiveness or something like that. But no one on the parish council is going to say that to me, you know, because that's not their job, you know. So there's that division of labor. You have kind of the, you know, and I mean, my priest doesn't come and boss me around either. He's a buddy, you know. I go to him because I know I need it. You know, it's kind of like your doctor, you know.
Yeah.
Your doctor is an authority, not because, you know, not just because he has a medical degree, but because, you know, you want to get better.
Yeah.
And you need to go to, like, you need to do what he says so you can get better, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of relationship. But then, of course, there's the kind of there aren't just priests, there's also bishops, you know, and a bishop is like a pastor to the pastors, you know. He's the shepherd to the shepherds. But you know, just to kind of compare and contrast here a little bit, because I've been a part of many different churches, there's no pope in the Orthodox Church. The decisions at the higher levels are made, what I believe the way they've always been made is through church councils. You know, so if there's an important decision that needs to be made, you know, bishops and clergy come together and they make those decisions, you know, through the Holy Spirit, but in the wisdom that they've been given in their, you know, and it's been passed down through generations to our church leaders, and I'm not saying, by the way, that there isn't a similarity in the Roman Catholic Church. I'm just saying, you know, there's that kind of manifest, obvious, you know, difference in the church governance. But then, like in an evangelical church where I grew up, there was no well, I mean, it was called a non-denominational church for a reason. We don't have apparently purposefully did, you know, rejected the idea that we would need to have some sort of governance or, you know, you know, it's kind of the joke about, you know, I know some church history. My pastor was born in 1965, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so that was kind of the, so just to kind of, you know, compare and contrast a little bit, it's conciliar, meaning governed by church councils at the highest level. But then there's also the monasteries, right? Because you have monks who, you know, and nuns, you know, who spend their lives praying, you know. And if you spend your life praying, I think that makes you into a kind of person that, you know, you have some wisdom, you have some connection to God that, you know, I am, you know, striving for. And I might go to a monk or a nun and say, you know, can you advise me on something? So there's that kind of, you know, personal guidance that you have too, from not just from your priest, but also from kind of, you know, elders and teachers,
yeah. other spiritual leaders.
Excellent.
Do you know what kind of relationship Holy Trinity has with other local religious organizations? Is there ever any interfaith fellowship? I don't know if there's.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, so even within the Orthodox Church, there's in the United States, there's different jurisdictions.
Yes.
You know, and so this is one of the interesting things, because a lot of people, you know, even like people in my family, they're like, oh, Adam's Greek Orthodox. And it's like, well, I'm not Greek, you know, and I don't, you know, I mean, so there's, but, But there's that perception about the Orthodox Church because a lot of our churches were established by immigrants. You know, so you have a Greek Orthodox Church, a Russian Orthodox Church, you have Serbians, you have Antiochian, you know, so kind of like a Middle Eastern presence too. And so you have these different kind of cultures even within Orthodoxy. So for example, my wife and I went for the first time to a Greek festival in Kansas City, and so there's, I guess what I'm saying is, even apart from just having, you know, relationships with other churches, even within the Orthodox Church, there's these different kind of, you know, cultures, different groups, you know, different ways of doing things in different parishes. But you know, that's a good question. Like, what do we do to have relationships with other churches? There's a local priest who asked me one time. He said, "You know, I'm part of this interfaith council that I guess meets in Kansas City, and so I know he does that. You know, and he goes and talks to other, you know, and I assume this is like, I mean, you know, ever, you know, whatever religions are represented in Kansas City, he gets together and kind of talks with leaders. But in terms of, are you thinking like teaming up with other?
I didn't know if you all like ever, like, just as a personal example, the church I work at, like, there's a First Christian Church like across the street, and like every like once a week we'll like get together and like do like making meals for food pantry kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if Holy Trinity had anything sort of similar or in that vein, or I didn't know if y'all teamed up with the Serbian Orthodox Church for the or the Greek Orthodox Church for the, any of the festivals that they put on.
I guess it's true. I mean, most of what we do is partnering with other Orthodox churches. Like, so for example, for like a food pantry, there's a church in Kansas City called Saint Mary of Egypt.
And they have a
ministry called Reconciliation Services, and so we have folks from our parish who financially support Reconciliation Services. They'll go down and serve, and so they'll serve a meal. I think they've renamed the Thelma's Kitchen, and it's a place where you can go in and it's kind of a pay what you can place that you can go in and have a meal, and so we have people from our parish who will serve and help out there and support that ministry a lot. So that's I think they're connected with the Serbians, I believe, so we do that. Then there are certain events that will that the churches will get together. So, for example, Theophany. Theophany in the Orthodox churches is a celebration of the baptism of Christ, and they have this they have a service called the Blessing of the Waters. And we'll actually go to Kansas City and stand. I think there's like a little like cutout statue of Lewis and Clark. I think it's like where the rivers kind of come together, and we'll stand there and we'll have a service, and the priest will, like, you know, bless the water, and because the teaching on that, of course, is that when Christ was baptized, you know, well, I mean, you know, we believe that he was God incarnate, is God incarnate, so he didn't need to be baptized, but he actually blessed the waters when he was in, so all of the waters in the, you know, we're blessed when he was baptized, and so we're commemorating that event at Theophany. And all the Orthodox churches, or almost all of them, will have some kind of representation at that, you know, at that service. So we'll get together for a service, we'll get together to serve together, camps, you know, we have a camp called EOIC, and you'll have a representation from many different churches with the younger kids at camp, and so there's a lot of mixing, I guess, that goes on around, you know.
That's great. So how have your children sort of changed how did having children sort of like change your experience with conversion? And you said your children also converted, and you said they weren't baptized, but how You know, how what's that like?
Yeah, that's a great question, man.
Really vague and open.
No, no, it's not actually. I have some really, I think, some specific answers to that because on one level it was quite challenging. So again, outsider coming into this sort of pretty foreign worship service, where I'm used to going to a church and I like drop my kid off at a basically like an in-house daycare, you know, and someone else watches my child, where I go in and I listen to a sermon and I sing some songs and I go pick them up and I go home. But you know, the whole paradigm of we're doing this as a family functionally means mom and dad are holding, you know, 6-month-old, 1-month-old, three-year-old, you know, who might be may or may not be throwing a fit in church right now through the whole service. And so having children was, you know, and coming into the church, that was a big challenge, you know. And I, so I'm not going to say like, you know, there isn't that difficulty of it. But the flip side of it is that I think it's helped me more than it hindered our conversion experience. Just for example, one of the things that Orthodox Christians do is venerate icons. And and what that means is, I mean, just, you know, either you're standing in front of an icon when you're praying and or you're, you know, bowing down before the icon, kissing the icon. And I was told by my Presbyterian pastors, for example, when I was considering Orthodoxy as an option, that this was idolatry. You know, I am breaking, you know, I'm breaking God's commandment to not have a graven image. And that was a bit of a, and I did some reading about that. You know, I mean, what's funny is like, this is not a new question. I mean, you can read, you know, in St. John of Damascus, for example, on the divine images, the iconoclastic controversy, and you know, you know, the Byzantine Empire, you know, or you know, I mean, this is a question that is, you know, has been recurring in church history, and it's, and I regard it as a settled question. You know, it's not idolatry, right? But at the time, that was a question for me, you know. And actually, St. John of Damascus is my patron saint. So when you convert, you adopt a patron saint, or they adopt you, so to speak. And the parish where I converted, there was an icon of St. John of Damascus, and he's the one who famously, you know, defended the use of icons in worship. And but he was a poet and he was a philosopher, and that combination is really inspiring to me, because I love the beauty and the wisdom, you know, and those two things kind of paired together. He wrote hymns, but he also wrote very kind of hard-hitting intellectual defenses of the faith. He was you know. And that combination of gifts, that just really spoke to me. So St. John of Damascus is my patron saint. In fact, when I go to communion, you know, the priest will say, "Servant of God, John." My name is Adam, but he calls me John because John is the name that I was given when I was baptized and chrismated. So the question of idolatry was there. And one, my daughter, who is now 10, I think at the time she was maybe 4 or 5. And I remember one night we were going to bed, it was around Christmas, and we had the manger scene out, and she wanted to pick up baby Jesus and kiss him goodnight, you know? And it was that image that has really just stuck with me, because it's like, it's not some kind of, you know, you're not worshiping the icon. It's a childlike act to kiss something, you know? It's you're coming, you're revering, you know. It's like kissing a picture of grandma goodnight. You know, grandma's not there, but you can look at her picture, you can give her a kiss and say goodnight. And it's more about what kind of connection that's developing in your heart as a worshiper, you know, or in this case a venerator, because veneration and worship are not the same thing. So we venerate the saints, we worship God alone, you know. So having children, I think for me, has really helped me to see things with more like childlike eyes, and that was really important for my conversion experience. Otherwise, I think I would have made a lot of assumptions about what was going on that could be explained in nefarious and uncharitable ways that are actually just pretty like human gut level kind of responses to, you know, to beauty, to in worship. So
that's great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for going into detail on that. Can you tell me about some of your best and worst experiences here? Or just best experiences. Sometimes people don't like talking about their worst experiences. I've had a couple people talk about the first Easter they spent here. So, like, just what stands out here at Holy Trinity?
Yeah. That's just kind of a hard question because
I know. It's like
well,
search your memory.
Maybe I'll interpret the question a little bit and then answer it. So I guess best does not always necessarily mean like pleasurable.
Yeah.
You know? Uh-huh. So like something that was really good for me was not necessarily the most fun thing, you know, or on the flip side of it, you know, you can have bad experiences that ultimately, you know, God can use for good things too. Mm-hmm. So, so I guess interpreting the question that way, if you don't mind.
Great way to preface. Thank you.
Yeah. One of the things I think it was hard for me, and still is hard for me actually, is confession. You know, because if you're going to go to communion, you're going to go to confession. I mean, that's kind of the way it is. Now, it's not a one-to-one thing. Like, I don't have to go to confession every Saturday night if I'm going to come to liturgy on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. But there are four major fasts in the calendar. And so, we're meant to be on a regular basis going to confession.
Mm-hmm.
And we have great priests here. And, you know, there's never been a time where my priest has been like, you know, anything other than a demonstration, an icon, really, of God's mercy for like my screw ups, you know. Mm-hmm. But there is something a little unsettling about going in and like, you know, unburdening your soul, you know, before another human being, you know. But you know, there's this prayer that he reads at the beginning of the confession, which is I'm going to summarize here. I can't quote it, but I'm just a man. You know, you're confessing to God, you know, but, you know, your priest is there as your, you know, he's your father, but he's your brother too, you know, and he's standing there, giving you the opportunity to get it out there, you know, and because all of our sin affects, you know, I mean, I know that when I sin, even if it's a private kind of sin, it affects negatively everyone around me, you know. So maybe I'll connect these two things. So the quote unquote bad, ultimately it's been good, but the terror of going into confession you could call that bad in a certain sense, but it's, you know, but it's good too, you know, but, one of the most beautiful services I think of the year is called Forgiveness Vespers. Mm-hmm. And what we do is on Sunday night, right at the beginning of Lent, the church comes together for an evening service, and at the end of the service, every person asks forgiveness of every other person in the church, and so you ask forgiveness of, you know, maybe 100 people, you know,
one on one, or
so you form two. They form two lines, and they basically just one by one, each person. And so I would just say, forgive me, a sinner. And the other person would say, God forgives, and I forgive. Forgive me, a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would prostrate ourselves or bow down before one another, asking forgiveness. And to me, that's a really important thing to do, because our sins are not just sort of like, you know, God looking at us, staring down at us mm-hmm. angrily, you know, you messed up. you know, it's more of a, you know, when I lose my temper, you know, I mean, it's not pleasing to God, but it's not pleasing to God because it's hurtful to my children or to my wife, or when I, you know, if I lie, you know, that introduces lies into the air, you know, and so people are believing things that aren't true, which is not healthy. It's not helpful, and so I see my sins as a public thing, and so along with public sinning comes public confession, you know. And it's not public in the sense that I stand up in front of the entire congregation and, you know, because that could cause problems for obvious reasons.
Yeah, of course.
But to have someone who is kind of a representative of that congregation to say, yep, I did this. So that's the bad or that's the hard part. Mm-hmm. But the beautiful part is that reconciliation that happens where you're extending forgiveness and you're receiving forgiveness, not in kind of this general way, but in a very kind of specific, tangible way where, you know, and at the end, as you can imagine, you know, we're all kind of stinking pretty, you know, B.O., because we're like, you know, we're making, you know, 100 prostrations and hugging each other. And it's just this really kind of visceral, like, you know, kind of moment of like love and forgiveness that is just so powerful. So that's kind of the two sides of that, the good and the bad, I guess.
Let me see. Before we sort of wrap up our interview, can you think of anyone else I should interview or anything else I should know sort of about either Holy Trinity or your conversion process or just anything in general that I might have left out?
Anyone else? Well, I kind of got stuck on that first question. Anyone else?
Oh, yeah.
You know, or anything that would have gotten left out. I can't think of anything that would get left out other than, I guess I would just say if you're interested in doing more interviews at Holy Trinity, one of the cool things about the Orthodox Church is how do I put this?
Take your time.
In a lot of congregations I've been a part of, you know, the mark of a Christian is sort of kind of faith that comes from understanding the Bible, understanding the message of the gospel, and a lot of it kind of resides up here, you know, in your head. But, you know, at the center of our worship is bread and wine, you know, and that's something that you don't have to, you know, whether you're, whether you're a PhD college professor or you have, very, you know, no knowledge of anything, you can participate in that, you know. And so there's an amazing range of, you know, of Christians Orthodox Christians that I get to worship with. And so I would just say, you know, there's a lot of amazing people here, and I would encourage you to keep digging if that's what if you want to do. So
totally excellent. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and